In the high-stakes world of naval command, split-second decisions can determine the fate of nations. Few understood this better than Admiral James Stavridis, who experienced this reality firsthand while sailing through the Strait of Hormuz in the mid-1980s. As Iranian missile sites illuminated his vessel with targeting radars, he faced the excruciating decision of whether to fire preemptively or exercise restraint. This moment exemplifies what Stavridis calls the commander's ability to make time slow down, synthesizing data, checking intelligence, and discerning enemy intentions while maintaining emotional composure. To risk it all has captivated military strategists and leadership experts alike since its publication, earning praise from figures ranging from General Jim Mattis to business titan Ray Dalio. The book's examination of naval commanders facing impossible choices offers timeless lessons in decision-making under pressure that resonate far beyond military circles. As Forbes noted, Stavridis has created a masterclass in leadership that should be required reading for anyone in a position of authority, while the Wall Street Journal praised its gripping narratives that illuminate the human dimension of command. Standing in the crypt beneath the Naval Academy chapel, one cannot help but reflect on John Paul Jones's defining moment aboard the USS Bonham Richard in 1779. When asked if he intended to surrender to HMS Serapis, Jones's defiant response, whether "I have not yet begun to fight," or more likely "I will make you strike first," became the cornerstone of naval legend. The battle itself was extraordinary. The Bonham Richard, a converted French merchant ship, faced off against the newer, better-armed Serapis off the coast of Flamborough Head, England. Despite commanding a sinking ship with nearly half his crew dead or wounded, Jones refused surrender, even as seawater flooded his gun deck and fires raged throughout his vessel. Jones's psychology played a significant role in his decision. A small, insecure man driven to prove himself against aristocratic opponents, he processed information and acted faster than his opponent in what modern strategists call an OODA loop: observe, orient, decide, act. By turning inside Captain Pearson's decision cycle, Jones gained the advantage despite his material disadvantages. His quick thinking led to crucial tactical decisions, including the daring move to lash the ships together, negating the Serapis's superior maneuverability and turning the battle into a brutal close-quarters fight. The battle's aftermath proved equally dramatic. When the British captain finally struck his colors around 10:30 p.m., Jones's victory was pyrrhic. The Bonham Richard was so badly damaged it sank the next day. Yet the psychological impact of an American victory in British waters was immense, demonstrating the young nation's growing naval capabilities and boosting continental morale. Though this victory marked the pinnacle of Jones's naval career, his later years proved disappointing. After the Continental Navy dissolved, he joined Russia's Navy under Catherine II, where his service as Pavel Jones was marred by a false sex scandal and political intrigue. Despite his previous heroics, he faced constant discrimination as a foreigner in the Russian court. He died in Paris in 1792 at just 45, largely forgotten until President Theodore Roosevelt, recognizing the symbolic importance of America's first naval hero, had his remains exhumed and reinterred at the Naval Academy in 1913 with full military honors. Jones's defiance embodied Churchill's famous never-give-in ethos and formed a bedrock of U.S. Navy culture. His legacy extends beyond his tactical innovations to encompass the fighting spirit he exemplified. The power of saying no, refusing to surrender no matter the odds, remains central to our naval tradition and national spirit, inspiring generations of commanders to stand firm when facing overwhelming opposition. From the War of 1812 to modern conflicts, naval officers have drawn strength from Jones's example, making his defiant stand aboard the Bonham Richard one of the most influential moments in American military history. Stephen Decatur's story exemplifies how youthful boldness, when properly channeled, can achieve the seemingly impossible. Between his commission at 19 and death at 41, Decatur defined the fighting spirit of America's young Navy. like Babe Ruth establishing baseball's culture or Bart Starr defining football excellence, Decatur set the standard for naval officers, but with national interests rather than mere games at stake. In February 1804, Decatur executed one of history's most audacious naval raids. After the USS Philadelphia ran aground and was captured by Tripolitans, he proposed sneaking into Tripoli Harbor with a hand-picked crew aboard the small USS Intrepid. Disguised as local merchants and sailing under British colors, they approached the Philadelphia at night, claiming to have lost their anchors in a storm. When the Tripolitans allowed them to tie up alongside, Decatur shouted, "Board!" and his men swarmed the frigate, quickly overwhelming the surprised defenders. Finding the Philadelphia unable to sail, Decatur ordered his men to set fires throughout the vessel. As flames engulfed the ship, they escaped under cannon fire from shore batteries. The burning Philadelphia drifted toward the ruler's palace, her heated guns firing randomly into the city. Remarkably, Decatur completed this daring raid in just 90 minutes without a single American casualty beyond one minor wound. British Admiral Nelson called it the most bold and daring act of the age, and at 25, Decatur became the youngest captain in U.S. Navy history. Decatur's approach exemplified three qualities that still resonate today: physical courage under intense pressure, balanced risk-taking with solid planning, and unwavering accountability. While his meteoric rise brought fame and honor, his life ended tragically in an 1820 duel with Commodore James Barron over a long-standing dispute. Despite this pointless death, Decatur's example of calculated audacity continues to influence military leadership and American risk-taking culture from Silicon Valley to professional sports. Damn the torpedoes! Four bells! Captain Drayton, go ahead! Jewett, full speed! With these legendary words, Rear Admiral David Farragut made naval history at the Battle of Mobile Bay. Lashed to Hartford's mast for a better view above the smoke, Farragut faced a crisis when the lead ironclad Tecumseh struck a mine and sank with over 100 crew members. The USS Brooklyn ahead of him stopped and began backing up, threatening to create a disastrous pileup of Union ships under Confederate fire. Faced with three choices, wait for Brooklyn to resolve its problem, retreat, or push forward through the minefield, Farragut chose the riskiest path. He gambled that most mines had corroded in the salt water, ordering his flagship Hartford to surge past Brooklyn into the bay. His calculated risk paid off. The fleet followed without triggering more mines and defeated the Confederate ironclad Tennessee in a fierce hour-long battle. By 10 a.m., the naval battle was won, though nearby forts would hold out for weeks longer. This victory effectively completed the naval portion of the Union's Anaconda strategy, choking off Confederate supply lines. For his success, Farragut became the Navy's first full admiral in 1866. Farragut's decision-making offers three key lessons. First, he adapted to revolutionary technological changes, transitioning from the age of sail to the era of ironclads and steam. Second, he took calculated risks based on thorough preparation. His "damn the torpedoes" moment came after reconnaissance and consideration of the mine's likely condition. Third, he combined rational analysis with personal courage and genuine care for his sailors, sharing credit generously while taking responsibility for the riskiest decisions. As a transitional figure between sailing ships and the modern steel navy, Farragut established a decision-making approach that balanced technological understanding, careful preparation, and grace under pressure, qualities that would influence naval leadership for generations to come. You may fire when ready, Gridley. With these understated words, Commodore George Dewey launched one of history's most decisive naval victories. The calm delivery of this famous order reflected both Dewey's measured leadership style and the methodical preparation that preceded the battle. After an agonizing three-day wait in Mers Bay, during which he drilled his crews and fine-tuned battle plans, his fleet sailed toward Manila. They first checked Subic Bay, which they found surprisingly abandoned by Spanish forces, a strategic error that would prove costly for Spain's Pacific defense. Dewey made the bold decision to navigate the wider but treacherous Boca Grande Channel under cover of darkness on April 30. This lesser-known passage was poorly charted and riddled with reported mines, but Dewey calculated that the risk was worth avoiding the heavily fortified Corregidor Passage. His ships, led by the flagship Olympia, maintained strict light discipline, with only stern lights showing to maintain formation. The Spanish shore batteries, caught off guard by this approach, managed only ineffective scattered fire. As dawn broke on May 1, 1898, Dewey's superior American fleet, consisting of 6 steel warships and 2 support vessels, methodically crossed back and forth before the immobile Spanish ships. Admiral Montojo had positioned his outdated fleet in shallow waters near Cavite City, hoping the nearby shore batteries would provide additional protection. The American ships, maintaining a distance of 2,000 to 5,000 yards, executed their gun runs with clinical precision. The Spanish fleet, though fighting bravely, was hopelessly outmatched in both firepower and accuracy. A dramatic moment occurred when Lieutenant Commander Gridley reported a critical ammunition shortage, prompting Dewey to withdraw his forces temporarily. This proved to be a miscommunication. The ammunition state had been misreported, but Dewey used the breakfast break to reassess the situation and rally his men. When the Americans returned, they delivered an overwhelming final assault that sealed the Spanish fleet's fate. The battle's outcome was stunningly lopsided. All 11 Spanish ships were destroyed, with 371 Spanish casualties and hundreds more wounded. American forces suffered only 7 minor injuries and 2 deaths, one sailor succumbing to a heart attack and another to heat exhaustion shortly after the battle. This remarkable disparity demonstrated not just superior American firepower, but the effectiveness of modern naval warfare doctrine. News of this victory electrified America and shocked the world, announcing the United States as a global naval power capable of projecting force thousands of miles from home. Dewey's success stemmed from his masterful balance of thorough preparation with bold action. Before deployment, he had secured extra ammunition, gathered detailed intelligence about Spanish defenses, and extensively drilled his crews in long-range gunnery. He methodically scouted positions and maintained strict operational security, then struck decisively when the moment arrived. This combination of logistical mastery and operational boldness became deeply embedded in Navy culture, establishing a template for future commanders who must maintain meticulous readiness while seizing tactical opportunities. The Battle of Manila Bay stands as a testament to the importance of both careful planning and decisive execution. In the chaos of Pearl Harbor, Doris Dory Miller's actions transcended duty and training. After manning an anti-aircraft gun with no formal weapons training, Miller's heroism continued even after expending his ammunition. He and others tried desperately to rescue Captain Benyon, who, despite heroically ordering them to leave him behind, succumbed to his wounds. When fire surrounded them, Miller and his shipmates escaped by pulling themselves hand over hand along a line thrown from a nearby crane 50 feet above raging flames. Rather than abandoning ship, Miller stayed aboard the sinking West Virginia, using his strength to pull oil-covered sailors from the burning water onto the relative safety of the deck. Despite exhaustion and disorientation, he remained until the formal abandon ship order came around 2 p.m., swimming 3 football fields to reach Ford Island. What drove Miller's extraordinary actions? Beyond training or orders, Miller demonstrated a fundamental desire to protect others, a trait evident throughout his life from his football days in Texas to his Navy service. His heroism, particularly remarkable given the Navy's systematic racism toward African-American sailors, exemplified the Greek warrior code that the opposite of fear is love for your fellow service members. Though initially unnamed in Navy reports, Miller's story spread through black press outlets and civil rights organizations, becoming a symbol for African-American enlistment. Despite congressional support, Southern senators and Navy Secretary Knox blocked his Medal of Honor nomination. Miller received the Navy Cross instead, presented by Admiral Nimitz himself. Miller continued serving despite facing increased racism from those who felt he had risen above his station. Tragically, he died when the escort carrier USS Liscomb Bay was torpedoed on November 24, 1943, with only 200 of 1,000 crew surviving. His body was never recovered. Miller's legacy helped drive Navy desegregation efforts after 1944 and continues to inspire examination of racial inequities in the service. A future Ford-class aircraft carrier will bear his name, though the Medal of Honor still eludes him posthumously. Admiral William "Bull" Halsey's decisions at the Battle of Leyte Gulf reveal how even legendary commanders can become fatally fixated on one objective at the expense of their primary mission. When Japanese forces executed their complex plan to draw Halsey's powerful Third Fleet away from the invasion beaches, Halsey took the bait completely, pursuing a decoy carrier force while leaving the vulnerable invasion fleet exposed to Admiral Kurita's powerful battleships. As Halsey attacked Japanese carriers far to the north, Admiral Kincaid realized with horror that only tiny escort carriers stood between Kurita's powerful force and the defenseless invasion transports. These small ships fought with incredible heroism while broadcasting desperate pleas for help, but Halsey remained fixated on destroying enemy carriers, ignoring their distress calls. By 9:45 a.m., Admiral Nimitz broke protocol and sent his famous inquiry, "Where is Task Force 34?" Due to communication protocols, Halsey received it with the unintentional trailing phrase, "The world wonders." Interpreting this as a personal rebuke, Halsey exploded in rage on the bridge. Only after his chief of staff confronted him did he regain composure, finally ordering his ships to turn south. But further delays for refueling meant his force didn't move until 1 p.m., by which time the battle was over. Admiral Kurita, convinced by the ferocious resistance that he faced a major American force, had retreated at 12:30 p.m. Halsey's reputation suffered further when he sailed the Third Fleet into a typhoon in December 1944, losing 3 destroyers, hundreds of aircraft, and nearly 800 men. A court of inquiry found him responsible, but Nimitz, known for leniency, kept him in command. Incredibly, Halsey sailed into another typhoon in June 1945, prompting another inquiry that recommended his removal, but Nimitz overruled this as well. Despite these failures, Halsey remained popular enough to receive his 5th star as Fleet Admiral in December 1945. His legacy shows how a bold leadership style can earn enormous trust, even when it leads to serious errors. His warrior spirit made him the perfect answer to the public's need for a fighter after Pearl Harbor, but his eagerness for glory and refusal to adjust to changing circumstances nearly led to catastrophe. The USS Pueblo incident presents one of the most agonizing command decisions in naval history. Lieutenant Commander Lloyd Pete Butcher, commanding a small intelligence gathering ship in international waters off North Korea in January 1968, faced overwhelming force when North Korean vessels surrounded his ship. Despite Navy tradition to fight until she sinks, Butcher surrendered without firing a shot to save his crew's lives. The North Koreans opened fire with 57mm machine guns, forcing Butcher to order the destruction of classified materials. The ship's incinerators proved inadequate, and sailors improvised burn operations in crowded hallways. Butcher chose not to man the ship's minimal 50-caliber guns, which were wrapped under tarps and offered no protection for gunners. After 7 minutes of heavy fire, Butcher ordered the Pueblo to stop without returning fire. His crew endured 11 months of imprisonment, beatings, starvation, and torture in North Korea. When they returned home, Butcher faced a court of inquiry that recommended court-martial, though Secretary of the Navy John Chafee ultimately decided against it, recognizing that Butcher had suffered enough. Butcher's decision not to fight back stemmed from multiple constraints. His vessel was at a dead stop when surrounded, his orders were to not start a war, and the Pueblo lacked proper armaments to engage multiple military vessels. The shallow waters made scuttling impractical, while resistance would have led to certain death for sailors exposed on deck. His situation demonstrates that context matters more than blind adherence to tradition. Unlike John Paul Jones's warship that could match its opponent, the Pueblo was essentially defenseless against superior firepower. Military tradition recognizes that surrender is sometimes necessary when truly overmatched. Butcher's decision wasn't cowardice, but a painful cost-benefit calculation that resistance would waste lives without protecting national secrets. Michelle Howard, born in 1960 to an Air Force family in Aurora, Colorado, became a pioneering naval officer who shattered numerous barriers throughout her distinguished career. Her journey began at the United States Naval Academy, where she graduated in 1982 among the first classes to include women. By 1999, she achieved a historic milestone as the first African-American woman to command a U.S. Navy ship, the USS Rushmore, a Whidbey Island-class dock landing ship. Throughout the early 2000s, she continued to excel through various sea commands and Pentagon roles, including serving as senior military assistant to the Secretary of the Navy. In April 2009, following her promotion to Rear Admiral, Howard assumed command of Expeditionary Strike Group 2 and the Anti-Piracy Combined Task Force 151, operating in some of the world's most dangerous waters off the Horn of Africa. The region had seen a dramatic surge in piracy, with over 100 attacks reported in the previous year alone, creating a significant threat to international maritime commerce. Just 1 week into her new command, Howard faced an unprecedented crisis when Somali pirates captured the U.S.-flagged container ship Maersk Alabama, marking the first hijacking of a U.S. vessel in modern times. The situation became even more critical when the pirates took Captain Richard Phillips hostage in a cramped 28-foot lifeboat, initiating a tense 5-day standoff. Howard immediately established a command center and coordinated a complex rescue operation involving multiple warships, including the USS Bainbridge and USS Halliburton, along with Navy SEAL Team 6 snipers and FBI negotiators. As tensions escalated over the 5 days, Howard demonstrated exceptional strategic judgment by making the crucial decision to delegate tactical control to Commander Frank Castellano on the USS Bainbridge. This decision proved vital as the situation required split-second decisions based on real-time developments. The crisis reached its climax when spotters observed a pirate aiming an AK-47 rifle at Phillips, prompting 3 SEAL snipers to execute a remarkably synchronized shot from the fantail of the Bainbridge, killing all 3 pirates simultaneously and rescuing Phillips unharmed. Howard's leadership during the crisis exemplified 3 fundamental principles of effective command: strategic delegation of authority to those closest to the action, genuine humility in allowing others to receive credit for success, and the ability to maintain composure while rising to unexpected challenges. Her approach emphasized the importance of trusting subordinates' expertise and judgment while maintaining clear strategic oversight. The successful resolution of the Maersk Alabama incident significantly enhanced Howard's already impressive reputation and helped pave the way for her continued ascent through the ranks. She went on to achieve several more historic firsts, becoming the first black woman to attain the rank of 4-star admiral and later serving as vice chief of naval operations, the second highest position in the Navy. Howard's handling of the Phillips rescue stands as a masterclass in modern military leadership, particularly when contrasted with historical examples like Admiral Halsey's micromanagement at Leyte Gulf, demonstrating how proper delegation and trust in subordinates can lead to mission success in complex, high-stakes situations. When COVID-19 struck the aircraft carrier USS Theodore Roosevelt in March 2020, Captain Brett Crozier faced an unprecedented crisis. With the virus spreading rapidly through the ship's confined spaces and limited testing capability, Crozier grew increasingly concerned about his sailors' health and frustrated with what he perceived as inadequate support from his chain of command. On March 30, Crozier made his fateful decision, sending a red flare email with the subject "Request for Assistance in Response to COVID-19 Pandemic" and a four-page letter detailing the Roosevelt's dire situation. He deliberately omitted Vice Admiral Merz from his chain of command, a decision he later regretted. "This is going to end my career," Crozier told his air wing commander. He was right. The letter leaked to the San Francisco Chronicle, embarrassing the Trump administration. Acting Secretary of the Navy Modley removed Crozier on April 2, citing extremely poor judgment, then resigned himself 5 days later after his controversial speech to the crew went viral. Chief Petty Officer Charles Thacker became the outbreak's only fatality. Crozier faced an impossible situation, a highly contagious virus spreading through a carrier where social distancing was impossible, incomplete scientific information about COVID, limited testing capability, conflicting guidance from multiple command levels, intense time pressure, and glaring national publicity. Unlike Jones, Decatur, and Farragut, who took calculated risks in combat, Crozier was in peacetime transit between ports. In the end, Crozier chose his crew's health over his career, a decision that cost him his command and future admiral stars. His case illustrates how modern naval leaders must navigate not only operational challenges, but also political, media, and public health considerations that their predecessors never faced.